I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
And we welcome him, a longtime friend of the program, friend of the fan, friend of everybody in the sports world, a guy that has written so many terrific books. And he's got an audio book out now called Friends I've Made. And obviously it's not all the friends he's made, but it's people like David Faraday and Steve Kerr and Tom Izzo and Coach K and Mary Carrillo. We welcome in John Feinstein. John, how you doing?
Richard, I'm good. I hope you are too. It's going to be kind of a strange Halloween today for my 10-year-old, but I guess we're all dealing with it, right?
Yeah, well, I'm just gobsmacked with the news that Sean Connery has passed.
He was the James Bond.
Oh, he was. And after we talk to you, I'm going to go through some of his other movie roles, because he was, you know, you think of him as James Bond, but he had so many other great roles, some that I'd even forgotten when I looked at IMDb. But we'll get into that later. Let's talk about your book. So it's an audiobook. Tell us how that came about.
Yeah, you know, this is new for me. I've done my books on audio, but I've never done a book that was designed to go straight to audio. And, you know, during the pandemic when I couldn't travel, I've been working on several projects, but a friend of mine, Bob Snyder, who runs a bunch of different podcasts, had been talking to me about doing a podcast, the way people do them, you know, once a week and things like that. And I said, why don't we do something a little different than that? Do something that maybe could be described as unique. And as you mentioned in your kind intro, I have known a lot of people in sports well for many years. And we put together a list of about 20 people who would be good interviews, were people I knew well enough, and who have interesting stories that maybe people don't know that much about. For example, I'm not sure how many people remember what Steve Kerr went through when his father was assassinated by the PLO in Beirut when Steve was a freshman at Arizona. His dad was president of the American University in Beirut, and that's why part of Steve's childhood was spent there. And there's a lot about Mike Krzyzewski and what he went through his first 3 years at Duke that I've chronicled and others have, but maybe not in the detail we got into in this particular interview. So we set up kind of a format where for each guy or woman, in the case of Mary, I would talk for a few minutes about them, how I got to know them, our relationship, and then interview them for 30 or 40 minutes. They're really more conversations, I think, Richard, than interviews. A number of people who've listened to the book have written to me that and said they felt like they were sitting around in a bar listening to us talk rather than, you know, a formal interview. And then I wrapped it up with an epilogue in each case. So the running time of the audio is about a little under 5 hours. And these are people, as I said, I know well. And one of the things as a reporter that you wrestle with is, where do you cross the line between covering someone, liking someone, and being friends with someone? And one of the things I've figured out in 40-plus years is that there are going to be people you like. There are going to be people you're closer to than others. And these are five people that I've been close to through the years and who I consider friends. In fact, I started the interview or the conversation with David Faraday by saying, look, David, I have told people that you and I are dear friends, and if you'd like to deny that now in order to protect your public image, please go ahead. And he said, who is this again? So
that's Faraday.
Yeah, classic David. So it was a lot of fun is what I'm saying in my long-winded way, and I think when people listen to it, they will learn things about these five people that they didn't already know.
Okay, so the decision to do it as an audiobook versus a podcast, how did that factor in?
Well, we wanted great detail. I think detail has always been my strength as a writer and as a reporter. And, you know, when you do a podcast, if you interview someone for 10, you know how it is. When you've done a million interviews like the one you and I are doing right now that lasts maybe 15 minutes, there's a certain point you can't go past simply because of time. And I wanted to have more time and more detail. And I felt that there are certain people you interview, and I know you've done this too, where you're told you got 4 minutes left and you're thinking, oh my God, how am I going to get through the next 4 minutes? I've done it, you've done it, we've all done it. These were people where that was not going to be a problem. They all have rich stories to tell. They're all very good at telling their stories. And I wanted people to feel like they were coming away from it saying, I didn't know that. That's always my goal when I'm writing, whether I'm writing a newspaper column or a book or, in this case, doing an audio book. I'd like people to come away saying, I didn't know that about Steve Kerr, Mike Krzyzewski, Tom Izzo, whomever it might be, David Faraday, Mary Carrillo. And I think we accomplished that in this audio book.
Well, you know, that was one of the things I had early in my sports career is I did a show called The Sports Connection on WNAW-AM, and we had a 45-minute segment just about every night where we do a long interview with a prominent sports figure. And the great thing about that, and most of them were pre-taped, you know, because you couldn't arrange, 6:30 every night, so you'd tape it in advance. And the great thing about that is the longer you talk to somebody when they get comfortable with you, and I'm sure these people were comfortable with you to begin with, but when they start talking, things come out that they might not necessarily say doing a interview with somebody for a TV show or a radio show or something like that. You get them at ease and you get them into that conversational mode and you find out things that maybe you didn't even know about them.
Yep. No, that's absolutely true. And that's a very good point. There's a reason why people call a soundbite, because that's all it is. It's a bite, and it doesn't really tell you much, and it usually involves someone saying they're giving 110% and trying to step up.
Yeah, exactly.
And we were past that from the very beginning in these interviews, because one of the things, you talk about time, one of the great things about doing books is you develop trust with your main characters, because when they have a bad day, I remember when I was doing the Mike Messina, Tom Glavine book years and years ago, Messina got bombed on a Friday night by Tampa, and I was supposed to see him Saturday morning before an afternoon game for a couple hours, and I got there on time. Mike was late, understandably, and he walked into the clubhouse, and I said, I'm guessing you're not really excited to see me today. And he said, you are the last person on earth I want to see today. And, you know, so we didn't talk that morning. And it was fine because, again, when you're doing a book, there's going to come another time. It's not like I was on a Sunday deadline where I needed to find a way to get him to talk to me. I could just back off. And I've been able to do that with golfers who've had bad rounds or basketball coaches who've had a bad loss, whatever it might be. And these are five people with whom I've established that sort of relationship through the years. And you know, I was with Mary the week that she quit ESPN, right in the middle of the U.S. Open, because she got sick and tired of them pandering to all the players. And there was an incident, you remember the Serena Williams incident years ago where she threatened a lineswoman. And ESPN refused to even mention it during the first week of the tournament the next year. Why? Because Serena was hurt and not playing, and they were negotiating with her to come on during the weekend to be part of their telecast, and they didn't want any, they were pretending like the incident didn't happen. And Mary finally threw her hands up and said, that's it, I'm done. And I was one of the people she talked to about it while it was going on. So, again, that gets back to trust, right? And so I think as soon as we started talking in each case for the friends I've made, they were comfortable. And if they weren't comfortable, they wouldn't have agreed to do it in the first place.
Now, John, when we're talking to John Feinstein, the book is called Friends I've Made, an audio book. Were you able to do this in person? Did you have to do it on the phone, Zoom?
No,
How did you actually record it?
On the phone.
Okay.
This was in July. I remember the dates vividly because the last one I did was with Steve Kerr on my birthday. And Steve said he hoped that I could find a bartender who would legally serve me a drink that night. you know, Steve is in San Francisco. David lives in Dallas. Mary's in Naples, Florida. Mike Krzyzewski's obviously in Durham, and Tom Izzo in East Lansing. So spread out around the country, and this is at a time before travel had really opened up. Fortunately, technology is such that it sounded like we were in the same room as we were talking. And again, fortunately, because that's a very good point you make, when I do long interviews for books, I almost always want to do them in person. But we're living in a time where doing that is very difficult. Only recently, if I started being able to go out and meet with people in person for the book I'm currently working on, and even then, you know, we sit outdoors, we wear masks, we're a long way from being out of this pandemic. But we did do them on the phone, and I really don't, again, because I know all five so well, I don't really think that was a negative.
Now, John, you talked for a long period of time with these people. Did you edit? Did you just say, well, you know, this story isn't so great, or this question wasn't so great? Did you edit, or did you pretty much leave it unexpurgated?
Well, we did edit it some, because what I wanted to do was go as long as I felt we needed to go. I didn't want to cut either them or myself short in terms of questions I wanted to ask. And for example, Mary is such a born reporter that there were several occasions where I asked her a question and she'd say, well, what do you think? And, well, no, nobody really cares what I think, Mary.
Yeah.
We want to know what you think. And so there were moments, there was editing done, but only in terms of time and in terms of making not that many decisions, but a couple of decisions that this is more important than that might be. Generally, the line I drew was if I felt someone was telling a story that people knew, that's what we would cut. I wanted to keep in everything that maybe people didn't know.
Now, did you go back when you listened to these interviews, because obviously you did before you put it out,
right?
You thought, oh, you know, I should have asked this follow-up question. Could you reach out to them and put something in that you didn't have before?
Yeah, technically, we could have. Yes, it was available. And obviously, as you said, I did listen back to I listened back to each of them individually after we'd done them so that I could get back in touch with them right away if need be. And honestly, Richard, there was nothing, because I did try to be prepared going into these interviews. It's not, even though I knew these people well, I went through stuff I'd written about them. I went through other stuff people had written about them and sat down and made a list of the questions I knew I wanted to ask. And a lot of times when I do an interview, and I know you're the same, you think your next question is coming from somewhere and then someone says something and you know you have to follow up. So you change your plan. A lot of times when I've interviewed some very famous people, quote unquote, there's a PR guy calling saying, can you submit a list of questions? And my answer always is no, because my second question will depend on the answer I get from my first question. So, but in this case, I did have a list of questions, but I wasn't wedded to it. I let the interviews lead me, as opposed to me leading the interviews. And I came away feeling like we had done a good, because we had as much time as we needed. You know, like, for example, Krzyzewski's PR guy, now you know I've known Mike since he was coaching at Army, and his PR guy, who's like a big protector, you know, said to me, oh, because I went through Mike to set it up, but the PR guy does his schedule, and he said, oh, he's only got 30 minutes. And I didn't even pay attention because I know Mike well enough to know he'll give me whatever time I want. So we took like an hour. And Mike never once blanched at all. And I felt like I got to everything I wanted to get to.
Yeah, I like to do it that way, too. If you're interviewing somebody for a long period of time, you want to have notes because there are areas that you don't want to forget to touch on.
Correct.
And yet, if you just read off the questions, you're going to miss those great follow-ups. And sometimes the follow-ups are a lot more interesting than where you would have gone if you just, you know, recited those questions by rote.
Well, it gets back to what you said earlier about, as well as I knew these people, all of them said things I either didn't know or didn't expect. And in each case, if I just went on to the next question, then I'd be missing something, because it would call for a follow-up. Well, how did you come to that conclusion? What made you feel that way? And I asked Krzyzewski when he first knew he wanted to coach, and he said it was when he was in high school, because he was the organizer of the schoolyard games in his neighborhood in Chicago, and that he knew then that he wanted to be a coach. Other guys come to it later. Izzo sort of fell into it after playing Division III college ball. Everybody's different. Mary Carrillo never planned to be on television. She was a tennis player, and then she hurt her knees and she couldn't play. And somebody put her on TV one night, and fortunately, you know Al Troutwig, right?
Right, yeah.
Al was the one who Mary sat next to him during a match at Madison Square Garden back in the old days when they played tennis in the garden. And she kept giving him notes about, I think it was Yannick Noah who was playing. She kept handing him notes, and Al never used it on the air. All the notes Mary was handing her, she was just sort of sitting there helping out. And Mary was thinking that Al was mad at her for handing her all these notes. And when the telecast was over, he said, come with me. He took her by the hand, took her down to the guy who was producing the telecast, I think it was Gordon Beck, and said, read all this stuff. She knows more about men's tennis than any of us. Why the hell isn't she on the air? And the next night, they put her on the air. And wow. You know what happened since sure. Then. Mary's become one of the TV television people, you know, in the business, not just through tennis, but through what she's done on Real Sports for all these years. And so there are stories like that that come up. And when you hear a story that wasn't supposed to happen, then you follow up on it. You don't just go to the next question.
Sure. Al Troutwig was a Delphi grad like I am.
That's right.
Many years later,
I forgot that. Yeah, he's terrific. By the way, I think he's wonderful.
Yeah, he's a really good guy. You know, David Faraday has obviously had addiction problems and has struggled with that. I mean, he's talked about it a lot. Were you able to get into that on a different level, or was he tired of talking? I mean, how did you handle that? Because that's very delicate, especially amongst friends.
David's very honest, as you said. About his addiction issues and tells the story about his first date with his wife, Anita, and how he was so drunk that he reached across the table and started drinking her drink. And the date ended very quickly and very badly. And as Anita says, for some reason, she gave him a second chance because he promised to show up sober, and he did. And soon after, they were in love, and it's been a great story. But we did talk about that, and we also talked, you want to talk about painful, you know, his oldest son from his first marriage died of a drug overdose a couple of years ago. And talk about something that's delicate to ask about, but again, David he talks about it and is honest about it, and his guilt as a father, and feeling like he didn't do some of the things he should have done, although he did everything that the experts told him to do. In terms of dealing with his son's drug addiction, and now he has a son who's a police officer in Texas. He actually went overseas for a while. He was in the military, and he said, you know, having lost one child, I'm terrified every single day that something's going to happen to Rory. His son is named Rory, not Rory McIlroy. And one of the great things about really all five of these people is there's nothing that was out of bounds. No matter how delicate it might have been, and David is the perfect example for you to bring up.
Well, and you're because you know these people so well and you're friends with them, they trust you. They know that you're not playing gotcha, that you're trying to get that quote that is going to be the head. I mean, sure, you're going to use quotes as headlines for the book, but you're not going to exploit that in a way that doesn't honor your relationship with them.
No, you're exactly right, that's a very good point, because shortly after David lost his son, I mean, I had written to him to tell him how sorry I was when it first happened, but several months later, Golf Digest asked if I would see if David was willing to sit down and talk about how he was dealing with everything. And I called him, and I said, how do you feel about this? He said, the only person I would trust to do this is you. And I did write the piece for Golf Digest, and it's a piece that makes you cry, not because I did anything, but because of David and how he's handled the whole thing. And there's a photo that ran with the story of David with his son when he was, I don't know, a year or two old, and he's swinging them up in the air. And if you can look at that photo and not cry, then you're a better man than I am.
Now, of the five, I don't know, you know, in terms of prominence, if Steve Kerr would be that guy or Coach K would be that guy. But in Kerr's case, I mean, he was a terrific player and everything. Everybody knows about his playing career. But when did he make the decision that he would coach? You say that Coach K knew that from organizing schoolyard games. When did Steve Kerr say, you know what, you know, I'm going to stay in basketball and I can coach?
Yeah, you know, he was very back and forth with it. He wasn't like Mike. His playing career, as you said, he played on five championship teams, three with the Bulls, two with the Spurs, and was underrated himself, I think, as a player. Because he used to like to say that, you know, I have deceptive speed. Most people think I'm a step slow. I'm really two steps slow. Well, he made himself into a very good defender and a good rebounder as a guard and was always a great shooter. When he was getting near the end of his career, his first thought was either television, because he's a natural on television, or being in the front office. Remember, he was president of the Phoenix Suns for a while. And he thought that that was a way to stay in basketball but not have to travel that much, because his kids were young back then. Now his kids are all grown. But it was when his youngest child went to college that he sat down with his wife, Margot, who he met in college, and said, you know, I wonder about coaching. Now that the kids are out, travel wouldn't be such a terrible thing. And you remember, everybody thought he was going to coach the Knicks, because of his relationship with Phil Jackson when Phil Jackson coached him in Chicago. And then the Warriors thing came up, and Steve sees many things, but he's not stupid. And he looked at the Knicks situation, and he looked at the Warriors situation with a rising young team, and plus he's a West Coast guy. And when he wasn't in Beirut as a kid, his family lived in Los Angeles. He was a UCLA ball boy as a kid. And they were living in San Diego, and moving from San Diego to San Francisco is a lot different than moving from San Diego to New York. And he ended up going to coach the Warriors, and we all know how that's turned out. One of the smartest decisions anyone has ever made in the history of sports.
Yeah, that is true. I wonder, did you get into how he feels about, you know, he had that dynasty going with all these great players and this great team, and now this past season, obviously the team went into the toilet.
Yeah.
How he felt about going from first to practically worst.
Yeah, he felt that, like, this was more or less a bye year, because, as you said, they've been in the finals 5 years in a row. They won three times. He's still a little bit upset about the way they lost that Cleveland series, because if Draymond Green hadn't gotten himself suspended, I suspect they would have won. But he looked at this as a kind of a bye year. Obviously, Kevin Durant won't be back, but they won championships before Kevin Durant got there, it should be remembered. And he thinks Curry and Klay Thompson will be healthy this year. Draymond Green is still there, and they have the second pick in the draft. So he thinks that this season, whenever it starts, should be back to where they were before Durant left, before Curry got hurt, before they ended up basically playing with a B team for most of last year.
Yeah, sir. You know, before we let you go, you mentioned when the season starts. The 22nd of December was something that the NBA floated. From the reaction we're getting, the players aren't so keen on that. How do you think that's going to play out?
I think if the NBA is smart, and I think Adam Silver is smart, unlike many commissioners, they'll go along with what some of the players seem to be floating right now, which is to start on Martin Luther King Day. Given everything that's happened in the last few months, it's a 3-week difference, basically. They won't get to finish the way they'll probably have to finish around the 4th of July as opposed to mid-June, and that's not perfect, but it's not that big a deal. They're going to play a shortened schedule anyway. Remember, a few years ago they played a 66-game schedule because they didn't start till Christmas because of the lockout. And last I looked, everything came out fine that season. So if they play 60 to 66 games and start on Martin Luther King Day, I think that would be a hugely appropriate thing to do. That would be very smart. It'd be smart business, and it would be terrific for basketball.
John, you know, one of the things about COVID that has changed in the sports world is that, you know, baseball experimented with some things this year. They said, 60-game season, we can do DHs, we can do all rules changes and such. Other sports, are they thinking about that? Are they thinking, hey, you know, we try some things. Maybe we don't have to have 82 games in the basketball season anymore. Maybe we can shorten it. Maybe we can do different things. Do you see that pervasive in sport because basically they got a bye this year because of what happened?
Well, I am hoping that most of the things baseball did will go away when we get back to normal. Obviously, the 60-game season, seven-inning doubleheaders. They don't schedule doubleheaders anymore anyway. And when they do, it's because of weather, and then they make each a separate admission. To me, the second guy on second base in the 10th inning is like Little League baseball. That's not real. I hope that'll go away. I know Manfred has talked about expanding the play, keeping expanded playoffs. I think that's a terrible idea. The problem, Richard, is this. Asking owners in any sport to do less, to put themselves in a position to make less money, as in a 70-game season versus an 82-game season, even though I think it would ultimately be a loss leader at the very least, is very hard. They want every dollar they can get. The NFL has already expanded its playoffs beginning this year, and I think it's going to be to ask sports owners to potentially give up money. When was the last time that happened?
Yeah, and players too.
You know? And players too. Although yeah. the ugly thing about the skirmish between the baseball owners and the baseball players was the owners always claim poverty. That's my big problem, Richard. I remember when the NFL had its lockout in 2011. And I said to one of the owners, I said, hey, you guys can't claim poverty. You're making too much money. He said, no, we're not claiming poverty. We do make a lot of money. We just want to make more money. And that was one of the most honest things I've ever heard an owner in any sport say.
Well, when we hear owners lost all this money this year, they lost all. Did they actually lose money, or did they not make as much money as they did in the past because of what happened?
I think you said it correctly. I think with the TV money still came in while they were playing, and they certainly made more money with the expanded playoffs. And by the way, I'm not criticizing Manfred, although I criticize him for a lot of things, but for expanding the playoffs this year, it was a unique situation. But I think they just made less money. Remember, starting from the top down in this country, we know how people can manipulate the books to make them look different than they really are.
Indeed, we do. Friends I've Made, the new audio book by John Feinstein, Amazon.
Yes.
Are there bookstores that have it, or how does that work now?
It's basically a download. You go on Amazon. I think you can go on BarnesandNoble.com too. But it's a download because it's strictly an audio book. I don't even know if they're making cassettes, to be honest. I am so technologically challenged that when people say to me, well, how can I get it? I say, find someone smarter than me who can tell you how to get it. But most normal people can get it fairly easily on Amazon.
Yeah, I mean, some of them are on compact discs, but they're going by the wayside, too, with streaming and downloading and everything else. So sometimes you don't get that nice package. You just download it, and there it is.
Yeah. You know, I bought my last car. When I bought my last car, which is 2 years ago now, 2.5 years ago, I insisted it had to have a disc player. And I never use it anymore.
Me either.
My wife downloads books for me on the phone, and that's how I listen to them.
That's it. Okay, John, a pleasure as always. We'll talk to you again real soon, I'm sure.
Richard, thanks. Always enjoy it. Thanks for having me.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.